area designated for declaration is the largest since the Oslo Accords. The group added, the year 2024 marks a peak in the extent of declarations of state land. Declaring Palestinian land as a state land is a legal maneuver aimed at confiscating land belonging to Palestinians by interpreting an Ottoman law that was utilized in a completely different context nearly two centuries ago. This legal tactic enables the Zionist regime to circumvent the technical legality of land ownership, as most privately owned land in the West Bank is not officially registered, Peace Now said. This declaration follows the U.S. imposing token sanctions on three additional Jewish-Israeli settlers earlier this month. This is in addition to the four settlers sanctioned by the U.S. last month in an apparent attempt to divert attention from its complicity in Israel's genocide of Palestinians in Gaza. Other countries, including France and the UK, followed suit. These sanctions falsely convey the impression that settler violence is caused by a few bad apples and sidestep the reality that the Zionist regime's illegal state-directed policy of settler colonization is inherently violent. The settlers are not acting as individuals, but on behalf of the regime, whose goal is the theft and total control of all the land in the West Bank. The Zionist regime has escalated its lethal attacks across the occupied West Bank under the guise of targeting emerging armed resistance. Israeli regime troops invaded the Nur Shams refugee camp on March 20 and killed four Palestinians, including two children. Dozens of Israeli armored vehicles, including bulldozers, raided the camp east of Tul Karm city in the northern occupied West Bank and began bulldozing roads and underground infrastructure in the camp. The Zionist regime army does this under the pretext of an increase in makeshift explosives planted beneath roads to target invading Israeli armored vehicles. We are seeing IEDs in Beit Lahm, in Al-Khalil, contributing editor John Elmer recently said. From the southern tip of the West Bank to the northern tip of the West Bank, armed struggle, qualitative increase in armed struggle, unquote. The Zionist regime troops caused extensive damage to the Nur Shams refugee camp's infrastructure, including the complete destruction of the square adjacent to the camp's main entrance. Israeli regime forces also damaged public and private Palestinian property in the camp, as reported by Wafa News Agency. Pictures circulated by local media show uprooted roads around the refugee camp, causing massive destruction to roads in commercial and residential areas. An Israeli drone-fired missile killed two Palestinians, including a teenage child, as Israeli regime troops invaded a camp. Iyad Nidal Kanu, 17 years old, and another Palestinian man, Nidal Mamun Abu Obeid, were killed in the strike. The Zionist regime then deliberately delayed the Palestinian ambulance access to them for 2.5 hours, according to a field report by Defense for Children International Palestine. Israeli regime forces fatally wounded another Palestinian child in a camp by shooting him in the head hours later. Abdullah Mahmoud Qaisi, 17, was allegedly participating in confrontations against Israeli regime invaders in the refugee camp when the Zionist regime troops shot him from a distance of 50 to 60 meters, then prevented ambulances from reaching him. And another injured man, DCIP added. Palestinians transferred Abdullah and the other man to a nearby mosque for hours until Israeli regime forces withdrew from the area and they were transferred to a nearby hospital. Also on March 20, an Israeli drone-fired missile struck a vehicle in the Jenin refugee camp, killing four Palestinians. The Jenin Brigade, a group associated with Saray al-Quds, the military wing of the Islamic Jihad Resistance Group, identified the victims as Ahmad Barakat, leader of military operations, Ziad Hamran, who shot and injured members of the Zionist regime's domestic spy apparatus, the Shin Bet, at the Gush Etzion junction near Beit Lahm earlier this month, as well as members Mahmoud Rihal and Mohammad Al-Fayed. During the funeral procession of the four men, Palestinians demanded that the Palestinian Authority release the abductees affiliated with the Jenin Brigade to allow them to bid farewell to their comrades before burial. The PA violently suppressed the protest by firing tear gas canisters at funeral attendees, resulting in injuries to four people, one of whom sustained a head injury. Meanwhile, a Palestinian man accused of collaborating with Israeli regime authorities was killed in the Jenin refugee camp on March 21st. The Zionist regime fire killed 32 Palestinian children in the occupied West Bank this year, 2024, including two U.S. citizens. Ayad Abu Ertiash of DCIP said, "Israeli forces' non-stop brutality is facilitated by Western countries, especially the United States, which continue offering the Israeli government unconditional support and sending weapons to the Israeli military, which are used to kill Palestinian children without consequence. When the Zionist regime fire is not killing Palestinian children in the West Bank, it is also leaving them paralyzed." In February, a Palestinian teenager was riding an electric bike with another man when an Israeli regime military vehicle rammed into them, knocking them to the ground. The young man managed to flee while an Israeli troop struck 17-year-old Amr Shuaidan with armored vehicle's door as he tried to stand up. An Israeli regime troop then shot Amr from point-blank range while he was already on the ground. As Amr lay bleeding, DCIP reported, one of the troops placed his hand on Amr's wound and shouted, "Die! Die!" Amr was eventually transferred to the hospital, where it was determined that the bullet fractured the cervical vertebrae in his neck, leading to spinal cord and paralysis of all four of the child's limbs.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, thanking Allah the Almighty in the holy month of Ramadan as a part of our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Ramadan Kareem, Ramadan Mubarak. What a beautiful month to be living in the holy month of Ramadan. Yes, it's difficult. Yes, it has trials and hardships, but a beautiful month indeed. And what blessings are in this holy month of Ramadan. Many of us, probably all of us, can never fully fathom the great blessings that are within this month. Of course, we are being purified second by second by the grace and the will of the Almighty Allah. So we're talking about shukr, we're talking about thanking Allah, we're talking about being grateful to Allah, we are talking about appreciating the Almighty Allah. Now, of course, you know, being grateful to Allah is a very fundamental thing, but despite being a very fundamental thing, many times we really don't pay too much attention to it. And matter of fact, the more we become engrossed in materialism and in this world and, you know, in this rat race and this hamster wheel that we have become stuck in, we tend to forget not only the afterlife, but we tend to forget simple things such as asking for forgiveness for our errors and our mistakes, and likewise thanking Allah for all the blessings that we have in our lives. I mean, truly, do we ever sit down and think about all the things and all the blessings that Allah has given us, has provided us, has endowed us with? Most probably we don't think twice about that. We don't think twice about the food that Allah has provided us during the suhoor, the pre-dawn fasting meal, right, that we have before we start our fasting. Or, for example, an iftar. You know, after our fasting, when we break our fast, do we ever thank Allah for the food that He has provided? And the list goes on and on to the various blessings that we have that we don't bother to thank Allah for.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, holy month of Ramadan, and we are talking about thanking Allah. Now, one way that you can thank Allah is by saying shukran lillah, you know, thanks be to Allah. Or you can say alhamdulillah, praise be to Allah. Or even in your own language, you can say, oh Allah, I thank you for all the countless and numerous bounties and blessings that you have given me. Right? These are different verbal forms in which we can thank the Almighty Allah. But of course, you know, the deeper it comes from our heart and the more sincere this gratefulness and this appreciation to the Almighty Allah is, the more impact it has on ourselves and our relationship with the Almighty Allah. Of course, that is another part of our Islamic lifestyle. And in the holy month of Ramadan, this is something that is easier to do, and that is to establish a connection and a relationship with the Almighty Allah. And what better way than to praise Allah? What better way than to be grateful to Allah, to appreciate the things that Allah has given you? So since we're running out of time on the program, one last point is that we should actively think about the things that Allah has given us to, you know, the extent possible, because when you start to count the things that Allah has given you, you will very quickly realize that there are so many things that you really won't be able to count all of them. Things as simple as, you know, having the health to be able to breathe or eat, or the blessing of family, or the blessing of the holy month of Ramadan, or the blessing of being a Muslim. When you start counting them, you will realize that there are many countless blessings, and you thank Allah for each one of these blessings. And every time you can bring up different blessings, you know, and you can speak with Allah, saying to Him that you have given me a certain bounty and a certain blessing, and I appreciate that, and I thank you for that, and you are so compassionate and merciful and kind and generous that you have provided these things without wanting anything in return. Thank you. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parsetoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
You lift me up high, you spread my wings and fly me to the sky. I feel so alive, it's like my soul thrives in your light. But how I wish you'd be here with me all year around.
This is the Heart of Life pounding IRIB English Radio.
As Israel's aggression continues in the Gaza Strip, more lives are being lost. At the same time, we're looking at the way that Israel's economy is suffering. But close to 6 months of this onslaught, there needs to be a review as to where the future lies for Israel when it comes to its economy, from its credit downgrades to disruption in its labor force. Let's review some of the highlights of today's program. First, the downgrade of credit of Israel is hurting it. The way that it has to get funds and loans has been impacted. And also, the continuation of the aggression relies on loans that it now can't get. So that puts into question whether it can continue the aggression or not. Other costs to Israel, well, you have Israeli-linked vessels and U.S. and U.K. Vessels also being targeted by the Yemeni army, impacting the maritime trade of Israel. That affects consumer prices. And, of course, the maritime trade decrease for Israel is another consequence. Then, when it comes to jobs, there's a lack of staff and labor force with an unknown future, especially on the political side. Massive company closures have also resulted, with no new companies coming into the picture. The U.S.-Israeli genocidal campaign continues to take Palestinian lives, but the toll on the Israeli economy and the West Bank also continues to rise. Downgrading of Israel's credit rating by the Moody's Credit Rating Agency is a significant factor. For the first time in 30 years, Moody's downgraded Israel's credit rating. After the downgrade, Moody's made another move. It lowered deposit ratings of Israel's five largest banks. Moody's also attached a negative outlook as the ongoing onslaught of Hamas, its aftermath and wider consequences would raise political risk for Israel. Moody's asserted that the aggression would weaken its executive and legislative institutions and its fiscal strength for the foreseeable future. This would have ripple effects on Israel's economy. A lowering rating increases borrowing costs for banks, which in turn will likely be passed on to consumers and will lead to higher lending rates. Time now for the social media post. The first one is from WikiLeaks. A WikiLeaks cable reveals Israel told U.S. officials in 2008 that it would keep Gaza's economy on the brink of collapse while avoiding a humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Next up, Uncle Sam, hiding fact, has said that Israel's economy dying, higher interest rates market demanded from Israelis, the spread between the Israel bonds and U.S. treasuries has never been wider. This is a vote of no confidence from a market, which the Israelis and Americans are trying to keep secret. That is something that needs to be looked at closer. Maybe this might have some kind of clue to what we just read. This post says the U.S. Treasury managed to underwrite a record issue of Israeli bonds to continue the war, we call it the onslaught against the Arabs in Gaza. The war financing comprised of $2 billion of five-year bonds and $3 billion each of 10- and 30-year bonds. And finally, BRICS countries are not only abandoning the U.S. dollar as its reserve currency, they're actually sanctioning the U.S. and Israel. How big of an impact will this have on our economy?
Hi, guys. I'm here in Dubai right now, and something massive has just happened. The BRICS countries, of which Dubai, which is part of the United Arab Emirates, the BRICS countries have actually put embargoes on the United States of America and Israel. Significant embargoes. And they've literally turned the whole tables. Because America have always shown their power because of their control of the Federal Reserve for so long that they've just simply stopped trading with certain countries and crippled them in history. Well, the power of the dollar has disappeared. It's evaporated. And the power of BRICS, well, they've taken control. And now what they're doing, they're literally putting the squeeze on. This has never happened before in history. America and Israel are being literally put to the sword by the BRICS countries. And if you're not awake now, then you never will be.
That's interesting. That maybe is good reason to do a program on BRICS and some of the moves that it's making, vis-a-vis, for example, the U.S. and the Israeli economy. All right, let's get down to the Q&A, our first one, and introduce our guest, Ross Advsaifo Mantula is our first guest. Thabo Mbeki, African School of Public and International Affairs, the University of South Africa, joins us. Welcome to the program, sir. Taking a look at what is happening here in terms of Israel's economy, we want to focus on the West Bank in this question. The economy there obviously has been very fragile. It's easily impacted now because of the confrontations that are happening with the Israeli regime forces and the Palestinians, basically apartheid practices and the oppression that they're experiencing. Given the increased violence from the Israeli regime forces against Palestinians, how do you see the economy of the West Bank and the future that it faces there?
You know, what is very important is to understand that the ripple effects of a conflict has an impact on economics and on the trade relations. And also when you look beyond the ratings, I think what is important for us to can contextualize the conflict in the Middle East, it is to understand that the conflict of Israel and Palestine, even in 2014, when there was one operation by Israel, there were already economic losses. And those economic losses, they are going into their governance. They are now spending more money into military equipment. They are also losing the workforce. So when you are losing workers, and at the same time you are having loans that you are doing, because remember, even after the 7th of October, they are already dealing with the business loss turnover of many businesses, people who have lost their jobs. So Israel is actually pushing the global economy into a difficult terrain that it will succeed out of.
Important point that our guest there makes. Let's bring in our next guest and find out from him what he thinks. Martin Sif is a former managing editor, international affairs, and former chief news analyst at United Press. Martin Sif, welcome to the program. We're looking at the West Bank here, and of course, the so many things that are plaguing the West Bank, from the violence to the question that I have for you, which is the restriction on the freedom of movement, where Palestinian workers have no way into the occupied territories. The majority of them have been actually barred from working in the occupied West Bank, and they can't work in their previous professions. Does this mean that Palestine's economy in the West Bank is doomed to fail, and that chances of it growing are can't be even gauged at this point?
Again, a difficult question. In conventional economic terms, I agree with your assessment. There is no question that they are suffering. But at the same time, it has not so far affected their ability to prosecute the war or the regime's determination to do so. The regime it does not preside over a united country. There was a rallying around the regime after October the 7th, but because of the failure of both the efforts to free hostages and the breakdown of negotiations with Hamas, and also the long-term prosecution of the war, it has not undermined the regime so far. but there has to be a cost taken. This is a very unprecedented war, and when the economic costs are affecting them in the long term, not immediately. Now, there are two ways this goes simultaneously. In the shorter term, because it is long drawn out, they can actually adapt in the short to the situation, because it isn't a sudden shock. It's a gradual intensification of pressure on them. And so far, they have been able to do that. However, they have never been geared to fighting long wars and maintaining the costs of long wars. I think we will see apparently no change for the next several months, but after that, there could be a negative change in their economic circumstances very dramatically and very fast.
It's time now for the InfoNews section of the program. First up, we're going to take a look at the company TikTok. It's been going through a lot when it comes to U.S. lawmakers, but what has happened is that there is a takeover in the making. Why? First, the House of Representatives has passed a bill that would basically ban TikTok in the United States, something that has been ongoing for quite some time. Well, it has finally happened. And now, the former Trump official, if you remember, Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, well, he has put forward a plan to actually buy TikTok. And what he has done is he's gathering investors to see when that's going to happen. We ask, doesn't this violate the free speech rights of millions of Americans who use the platform daily to communicate and stay informed under concerns over user privacy and national security? It just shows what the U.S. can do under the notion national security. Up next, a headline that caught our attention is about oil and its demand, global oil demand to grow amid the Red Sea shipping disruptions. The International Energy Agency says that shipping disruptions provide a short-term boost to the oil market, with demand to hover at around 1.3 million barrels per day. Now, the oil market will actually face a supply shortage, based on one report, by the end of 2025, because the world is not replacing crude reserves fast enough. Next up, taking a look at Iran's economy. A couple of pieces of news on that. The first one, Iran's aluminum has actually grown in terms of its output by 7%, this being for the month of February of this year. Then we took a look at Iran's export of agricultural products, up 13% in 10 months. So it shows how Iran's economy is just humming along. Next up, and our final look is at world poverty, where this particular headline said, are the poorest countries being left behind? It said back in 2015, world leaders made a pledge to leave no one behind. These countries were in a larger grouping of 51 countries of low-income status toward the end of the 1980s. However, after more than three decades, these 22 countries are still of low-income status today. Those were the topics we picked for our InfoNews section. And let's bring back our guests to find out what they think about it. We have Ras Adva Sifo Mantula, who rejoins us, Thabo Mbeki, African School of Public and International Affairs at the University of South Africa. Welcome back to the program. Let's take a look at about these unemployment benefits, for example, that Israel has at this point recorded 260,000 of them since the beginning of the onslaught that happened back in October. 42,500 of these applicants are currently on unpaid leave. And we're looking at the private sector in Israel to continue to suffer because it doesn't have anyone to fill in the jobs. What are the chances of Israel's economic recuperation, do you think?
Absolutely. The main challenge is that once we have multinational companies, once we have small companies affected by conflict for more than 3 months to 4 months now, you'll definitely have negative consequences. Now, for the companies to survive, remember when COVID-19 hit the globe and the world? Also, Israel was not suffering per se because it had its own medical supplies. But now the main challenge of the loss of workforce. Now the issue is that for the United Nations, for the African Union, for the Arab League, for the countries that are paying their allegiance and their pledge their solidarity with the conflict in the Middle East, the issue of the labor laws and the labor rights of ordinary workers, the right to trade by business has to be respected. And hence you can find that the issues that the World Bank has already raised when this conflict erupted also. There was a good report that the World Bank came with actually in October, and after 3 weeks after the war. And it also pointed out the issue of the tourism that will be affected by the neighboring countries, the issue of the lower surplus, and the people losing their jobs. So how are we going to deal when people just came out of COVID-19 years ago? How will people survive?
All right, that's obviously one of the things that concerns Israel. It's his future. Let's find out what Martin Seif thinks. Martin Seif rejoins us. He's a former managing editor at the United Press. Martin Seif, welcome back to Economic Divide. You know, taking a look at Israel's future, currently we're looking at one of the major areas that there's a disruption in, and that's labor shortages. In terms of unemployment benefits, you had about 260,000 who have applied for these benefits. But overall, you're looking at store closures and a lack of employees, and even for stores to get back on their feet. What are the chances of Israel's economic recuperation, do you think?
Again, you have asked a key question, and until there are serious negotiations, there is no positive answer. My own view is that the Biden administration in the United States bears a great deal of responsibility for this, because Antony Blinken, who is a very passive, he's very aggressive against Russia and in prosecuting the war in Ukraine, but he has been very passive in the Middle East, and he has taken no effective action to restrain the Israelis or to try and put pressure on Hamas either, for that matter. I am, as you know, quite an old fellow, and I covered the Middle East. It was my first great adventure outside Ireland back in the era of Henry Kissinger, which is half a century ago. Now, Kissinger was very heavily criticized at the time, and the Israelis, as now forgotten, disliked and distrusted Kissinger because he forced them to make more concessions than they wanted to make. But the key to Kissinger was he kept the pressure on Israel and he kept the pressure on Syria and Egypt. His priority was to end the major conflicts between nations. He was not focusing on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and he did really nothing on that whatsoever, nothing constructive. But he did end the continual states of war that had continued for a quarter of a century virtually between Israel, Egypt, and Syria. And he did so by keeping going back to the region, staying there for weeks and even months at a time, and maintaining the pressure on both sides, including Israel. He really pressured the Israelis very significantly. We have not seen any of that so far. And frankly, I believe Secretary of State Antony Blinken does not have the character, does not have the determination, does not have the guts, and doesn't have the intellect to do what Kissinger did. He does not realize that diplomacy is not simply a matter of going somewhere and reading your complaints and then going away. You have to maintain pressure. It is not just a gentleman's game. You have to continue to pressure and negotiate with people on all sides, but you have to focus on the priorities.
Israel has a tough task of trying to cut expenditures during the time that it continues its aggression. After the start of the onslaught, many families living around the Gaza Strip, as well as in the north of the occupied territories and at the border of Lebanon, have moved to hotels, motels, and rental apartments. This is being subsidized by the Israeli budget. The head of the Hotel Association of Israel has stated that 50% of the hotel rooms are allocated to people displaced from around Gaza. Parallel to this, the tourism industry has seen an unprecedented slump. The regime earned $5.5 billion from tourism in 2022, with 2.5 million tourists visiting the occupied land on average. However, after the Al-Aqsa storm operation, tourism was severely damaged, and the number of tourists in the months of October and November of 2023 was 89,000 and 38,000 respectively, and reached zero in December.
So I hope that the situation will change and the pilgrims will come as soon as possible, because this is important for us, like the Franciscans, like the keepers of the holy places. Because the pilgrims are the prayer, they're praying with us, they give the life to this church.
Hello and welcome to the Quick Take section. I'm Mahdi Abbasian. The Yemeni army has continued to incur losses for the Israeli regime when it comes to maritime trade. These attacks have become more intense in recent weeks, and due to the dependence of more than 90% of the trade of the Zionist regime on the sea, it has imposed a heavy economic cost on the regime. The Israeli regime has had to act to make sure that Israeli-bound ships made their journey to occupied Palestine. It has introduced an incentive for that to happen. Israel has offered to pay compensations to the ships that are damaged by the onslaught on the Gaza Strip. Despite that, some shipping lines have refused to transport cargo to the occupied territories through the Bab el-Mandab Strait and the Suez Canal due to the insecurity in the Red Sea. The cost of transportation and insurance has increased significantly. Here is one example of what the Yemeni army is doing. The Belize-registered Rubimar is the first vessel lost since the Yemeni army began targeting commercial ships in November. According to Yemen, the number of targeted ships and warships has reached 73. When it comes to the Red Sea, the Arabian Seas, and the Bab el-Mandab Strait, including the Suez Canal, it is worth mentioning the importance that they have for shipping. For example, the Suez Canal shipping route that leads to the Red Sea is an important waterway for world trade and is used to transfer goods and energy between Europe and Asia and other regions of the world. This route saves time and money by avoiding bypassing the African continent. According to the analysis of the freight tracking company Fritos, the rate of shipping goods from various Chinese ports by ocean route to Israel for each 40-foot container has increased from $1,975 at the end of November to more than $2,300 on December 12th. Also, the time to reach the destination has increased by at least 18 days. On the other hand, the port of Eilat, which is located on the coast of the Red Sea, has been practically closed due to Yemeni attacks on this port and the lack of movement of ships to it. As a result, the trade of the Zionist regime is carried out through ports located in the Mediterranean Sea. With the closing of Eilat port, this regime must use Ashkelon and Haifa terminals to import its oil, which poses security risks to the Zionist regime.
When it comes to the future of Israel and its economy, a lot of unknowns are there. One of the things, obviously, that is hurting Israel is the lack of cash. The funds are not there to continue with this onslaught, and not just that, but also for its local economy, for it to survive. That is where the U.S. comes in, but the U.S. is at odds with Israel at this point. Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, has said that there should be new elections there, which adds to more political uncertainty. Only time will tell whether they can survive this turbulent time that is experiencing. That does it for this edition of the program. Thank you so much for being with us. From Mikko Metafi and the entire team at Economic Divide, it's goodbye until the next program.
چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of Truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
In the heart of Imam Khomeini's way of thinking, ethics had a special place, and in fact, all areas of knowledge revolve around this pivot. According to his view, by citing a hadith, prophetic tradition, from the Messenger of Allah, all kinds of knowledge can be placed in three general categories. It is because the human being possesses three existential presences and three types of world. One, external and sensory, another, the allegorical world, the third, the intellectual one.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience. Welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. On the subject of Imam Ali alayhi salam and his character, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, Imam Ali alayhi salam had been a divine miracle who promoted and enhanced the justice in the world. Well, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi in this sentence focuses on the justice of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Imam Ali's life and justice are closely bound up with the history of Islam. He regarded people with reverence, whether they were Muslims or non-Muslims. He did his best to distribute wealth and spoils among them justly. Some great Arab men stated their grievance openly because that their share from Bayt al-Mal was equal to that of the poor. At the beginning of his rule, Imam Ali alayhi salam said, I will summon those who have deprived people of their rights to the court and I will apply the law to them, even though it doesn't please them. Considering this hadith, Imam Ali alayhi salam recommended people, especially his officers, to be just to everyone, whether acquainted or not, and to fulfill their promise when they are in treaty with foreigners.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi.
صلى الله عليه
صل يا
رسول الله
يا ربنا صل على طه النبي وآله.
It is written that the commander of the faithful alayhi salam paid great attention to certain issues during his eventful life. Justice and unity were among the things he always paid great attention to. These are great lessons for us. Administration of justice in the Islamic society was important to the commander of the faithful alayhi salam. The fact that he always pursued justice is evident in all cases. He went through the most difficult tests of his life, the difficulties and wars which were imposed on him as a result of administering justice, and he tolerated great hardships such as three wars he fought during his brief rule. This is because he always sought to administer justice. He always pursued justice decisively. He also gave up his own rights for the sake of God, Islam, and unity of Muslims, and never engaged in any confrontation. And that is why Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh praised the justice of this great Imam, because no one in the history could bring justice to its real sense like Imam Ali alayhi salam did. Until another episode, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Every night and every day. إله إلا الله.
Ramadan in the UK.
Part 1.
Ramadan, the month when Muslims refrain from food, drink, and marital relations during daylight hours, is a special time for Britain's 3 million Muslims. Physical and spiritual rewards are worth it.
Ramadan has been a fantastic time in the sense that it's about spiritually connecting with the law of the heavens and the earth and detoxing your bodies.
Ramadan is the month of prayer in the Quran, when Muslims do their best to cultivate willpower, discipline, and self-restraint. They also increase their charitable activities and empathize with the poor, needy, and destitute.
We feed people, we sit together and we share food with everyone, and this is part of it. Because they don't have it, we bring the food to them. They can't come to us, so we bring it to them. And that's the whole thing about Ramadan, which is, you know, you share and you care.
But Ramadan isn't just about self-sacrifice. It's about sharing food with your family and friends. It's about increasing solidarity with your Muslim brothers and sisters at home and abroad. And it's about showcasing the beauty of Islam to the non-Muslim majority living in the UK.
Certain headlines are putting the lives of many innocent people at risk. So what can we do?
With Islam and Muslims regularly demonized in the British media, Ramadan is a golden opportunity for Muslims to showcase the true Islam. And I've been traveling around the country during the holy month in search of exactly that. Like many Muslims in majority non-Muslim countries, British Muslims can sometimes be the subject of unwelcome scrutiny. Sometimes being a Muslim in Britain can feel a bit like being under siege. So the month of Ramadan, when Muslims fast from dawn to dusk, can come as a welcome relief for many. A time for physical and spiritual renewal, as well as an opportunity to improve relations between Muslims and non-Muslims alike. The Hussein family, who live in North London, are getting ready to break their fast. Like British Muslims all over the country, the Husseins have spent the last month fasting, so the evening meal will come as a relief. Mrs. Hussein is also preparing some food to take round to her non-Muslim neighbours.
Could you encapsulate what Ramadan means for you, Zishan?
For me, it's reconnecting with my Lord. It's like understanding what is the purpose of your life, which is to worship your Lord and to be the best person that you can be.
Salman, can I ask the same question?
Yeah, for me, it's about reprogramming, deprogramming all the bad habits I've gotten into, kind of reprogramming what's required of me from my Lord, and self-discipline.
Fasting is compulsory on every Muslim who is sane and mature, male or female. It has many physical, moral, and social benefits. But most importantly, God has made fasting compulsory so that Muslims become pious, fearing, and God-conscious.
We know that the shaitans are locked up during this month. And for me, that's definitely something that I notice. It becomes a lot more easier to pick up the Quran, spend a little bit more time on the Quran. And you notice like small habits changing. So when you're on the tube, like on my phone, I'll get the Quran out. I'm much more likely to get the Quran out and start to read as I'm sat commuting. And it's like you sort of, because you're sort of waiting for the time when you open your fast, you realize that I can use this time to do things that are better than just wasting time watching TV or Facebook or whatever.
I made Ramadan gift bags for my neighbours, my non-Muslim neighbours, and I distributed them with a little note saying what Ramadan means to us. In terms of my Muslim community, yeah, we've had a lot of Ramadan iftar invites, so we've been going to them.
It's time to break the fast during a meal which is known as iftar, I join my hosts in a lovely and refreshing Asian dinner. Often Muslims will overeat at this time to compensate for what they've been missing out on. But the correct Islamic etiquette is to fill two-thirds of your stomach with food and drink and leave the last third empty. Tonight, at least, I think we've stuck to that.
The Quran is a unifying factor for Muslims of all different traditions, sects and cultures. All Muslims believe it's the literal, unchanging word of God, and they strive to live their lives according to its strictures. Now, the recitation of the Quran is considered something of an art form all across the Muslim world.
Ramadan was the month during which the Quran was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad, and many Muslims will attempt to recite the whole book before the month ends. The very act of fasting is prescribed in the Quran so that, the Holy Book says, believers can learn piety. The rules of fasting are also set out in its pages, with those unable to fast due to illness, travelling and old age exempt. This is because God intends ease for us.
The message of the Holy Quran is to guide the human being. That is the book of guidance. That is the book of guidance to all universe, not just Muslims, because this book is not written by a person. It's the words of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That is from secure source. So it is the book of past, the book of present, and the book of future.
Muslims believe the Quran was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad over a period of 23 years. The Holy Book emphasizes the duty of mankind to worship, fear, love, and obey the one God who created the heavens and the earth, the God of Muhammad, Jesus, and Moses. If the Quran's central message is monotheism, it also teaches Muslims how to live a good life, which will ultimately grant them entrance into paradise, and how to avoid the sins which will consign them into hell. During the month of Ramadan, prayer is also a priority for Muslims. Believers are required to pray 5 times a day, even outside of Ramadan. But during the holy month, Muslims will often perform additional prayers, especially in the mosque. Again, the prayer is a combination of movements and gestures, which symbolize submission to God, as well as Quranic recitation, which reminds believers of His holy words.
This is the month of revelation of Quran. So he wants us to attach yourself with Quran, because the rewards are multiplied in the month of Ramadan. He has given the attraction to the people. Okay, if you read, normally you are rewarded 10 times. In this month, you will be rewarded 70 times. People think that being thirsty, if you do not eat and do not drink anything, that is fast. No. There is a fast of your stomach. There is a fast of your eyes. There is a fast of your ears. There is a fast of your tongue. There is a fast of your hands. And there is a fast of your food as well. Like the whole body should be fasting, not just your stomach. If you're hungry and still you're abusing people, Allah says, I have nothing to do with your thirst.
This is the time that we spend more time on ourselves. Because rest of the year, maybe we are very busy with, you know, day-to-day work. But in the months of Ramadan, our physical activities, maybe our, you know, some of our contacts reduce, so that we have more time for our contemplation and, you know, prayer, recitation, and being with the community.
Ramadan is a time for communities to come together. Every night at dusk, the fast is broken, most often with family and friends or in the mosque. It's a great opportunity for people who don't see each other much the rest of the year to get together. And it's also a time when Muslims belonging to different sects unify.
I'm trying to think back, have I been to any Shia mosque? I don't think I have actually ever before. I mean, I know there are some slight variations in prayer, and I know that's the kind of the timings for iftar are a bit different, but that's it. That's the extent of my knowledge actually. about Shias, but again, and Shias are a vast, you know, there are many different schools. I actually don't know much about Shias. So yeah, let's see what happens.
Raza Nadim is a Sunni Muslim, which means he belongs to the majority sect of Islam. But tonight he'll be breaking his fast at a Shia mosque, Islam's minority sect. Sunnis and Shias share a belief in the major tenets of Islam, such as God, the Quran, and the Prophet Muhammad, but they may differ on other details of Islamic jurisprudence and history. In general, the two sects have coexisted in relative peace throughout Islamic history, with some exceptions, of course. But with political events in the Middle East currently at boiling point, sectarian tensions can sometimes spill over.
Without having unity, we would be not able to face our challenges. And indeed, we would be just challenging ourselves internally and exhausting ourselves without reaching to any conclusion.
What terrorist groups want to do, they want to create division between the Muslims. They want to create, you know, an us and them situation between the Muslims and also then between the Muslims and the wider community. And if we are really fighting amongst ourselves, then that really, you know, makes them a winner. And we want to make sure that we believe in the same God, we believe in the same Holy Quran, and those who believe in the same, you know, scripture, you know, they are part of the creed of Islam. You know, and the concept of takfir is absolutely cancer in Islam. You know, it's eating us away.
Shia Muslims break their fast a few minutes later than Sunni Muslims do, and they tend to combine the sunset prayer and the night prayer, called Maghrib and Isha in Arabic, unlike Sunnis. But these minor differences between the sects don't seem to bother Raza too much.
It's different. I mean, it's a lot of similarities that you see in the way people pray. Some similarities. But yeah, I didn't realize that they combined the Isha as well during Ramadan. I thought that they had a Tarawih prayer, but I'm guessing that doesn't happen. But yeah, and the food was good. It's better than my local mosque, that's for sure. Right now, you see Muslims being attacked left, right and centre. The last thing you want is to be fighting amongst each other. And I think a lot of it is misunderstanding. So, I mean, you know, earlier they were doing the recitation of the Quran. There was no difference. It's all the same. People sitting there remembering God, you know, glorifying the Prophet. And it's so many similarities. And for me, I mean, I knew that there were many similarities, but to see them in action, that is, you know, it just kind of breaks a mental barrier. And I think especially for a lot of Muslims that are quite hardline sectarian on both sides of the camp, I think they should go to different mosques, just because you realise we're not that different. And yeah, we all like our food at iftar time.
With you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Iran's consulate building in Syria's capital Damascus comes under attack. Several people have been confirmed dead. Iran and Hamas call for an international investigation of crimes committed in Gaza's Al-Shifa hospital. And the Islamic